And now it's my pleasure to introduce Caitlin Etherton, an outstanding student in our graduate creative writing program who is this year's Levis Fellow. And in that role, she oversees the day-to-day operations of the annual Levis Reading Prize competition. Caitlin will introduce tonight's honored guest, Caitlin Etherton.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you to our sponsors, the VCU Department of English, VCU Libraries, Barnes & Noble, and the College of Humanities and Sciences. And thank you also to Emily Block, who isn't here tonight, who was last year's Levis Fellow, who facilitated Cave's arrival. Thanks also to Tom Dodato, Gregory Kimbrell, and the Bow House Press. And thank you all for making time this evening for poetry. I am Caitlin Etherton, this year's Levis Fellow, which means in addition to handling reviews for the 2019 Levis Reading Prize, I have the honor tonight of introducing the winner of the 2018 prize, poet Kaveh Akbar. Kaveh was born in Tehran, Iran, grew up mostly in the Midwest, and currently lives in Indiana. In 2014, he founded Dive Dapper, a free online collection of poetry interviews. In 2016, he received the Ruth Lilly and Dorothy Sargent Rosenberg Poetry Fellowship. In 2017, he published both a chapbook, Portrait of the Alcoholic, as well as a full-length poetry collection titled Calling a Wolf a Wolf. And then he received a pushcart. Kaveh's poems have appeared in The New Yorker, Poetry, Tin House, APR, and PBS. He teaches at Purdue University, Randolph College, and Warren Wilson. Somewhere along the line, he became a columnist for the Paris Review. And in a recent interview with Glass Poetry Press, Kaveh said, "I just don't sleep that much." Calling a Wolf is a three-part book of poetry that contemplates addiction, personal history, hunger, joy, faith, and the divine. Here is a world where sometimes God is rest, where old men in orchid penny loafers furiously trade orchids, where brackish water trickles in to the brain and memory trickles out, where we all want the same thing, to walk in sincere wonder, like the first man to hear a parrot speak. In interviews, Kaveh speaks often about this necessity of wonder. And in a conversation with Dinesh Smith, Kaveh mentioned that his students are exhausted with him repeating Horace's pronouncement that a poem should both delight and instruct. In his poem, Exciting the Canvas, Akbar writes, "Some people born before the Model T lived to see man walk on the moon. To be strapped like that to the masthead of history would make me frantic. At parties, I'd shout, 'I'm frantic, and you?' Only seven lines, and already we readers have traveled from a noisy living room house party to the Ford plant in Detroit, to the surface of the moon, to the tip of a sailboat, the press room of a newspaper. Already we have had seven, eight, maybe a dozen moments of feeling just so frantic." During my time as an MFA student, I have volunteered at VCU's Bow House Press, a letterpress studio within the School of the Arts. The letters we arrange are very tiny, and typos are unavoidable. But last week, while typesetting the end of Kaveh's poem Milk for tonight's broadside, I was surprised to look down into my hand and realize that I had accidentally mistyped not just one or two letters, but an entire word. In the second to last line, rather than spelling D-R-E-A-M, dream, I had individually chosen and set the letters for L-E-S-S-O-N, lesson. I leaned in close to the poem, slid each letter of lesson out with tweezers, and dropped dream into place, careful not to disturb the tension of the stanza. Again, I was reminded of the poem's ability to instruct and delight, to lessen and to dream, to bewilder and to involve. Perhaps the logic of dreams is not so predictable. The unexpected happens. Then what? Akbar asks. The next thing, he replies. If I am punished for any of this, it will be thousands of years too late. Please join me in welcoming Kaveh Akbar.
Thank you so much, Caitlin. I kind of just want Caitlin to be up here and read my poems. She did a really amazing job with it. My name is Kaveh Akbar. I'm so honored to get to be here and to get to be among with you all. Thank you, Greg, for that incredible essay and for your hospitality broadly. Thank you, everybody who's been so kind to me today and broadly in association with this thing. I'm very excited. I'm very excited to be here with you guys. This is a beautiful space that you've built and a beautiful community, and I feel very among. I'm going to read some poems. I know that I'm here because I wrote this book, which is in very big letters right there. But I'm going to read some new things, too, and maybe that's okay. I like to figure things out. Thank you all, again, for being here. I appreciate it. I hope I get an opportunity to substantively interact with lots of you after this. This first poem I'm going to read is called Vines. They're fat, wet, vines creeping into my house through the pipes and through the walls, gentle as blue flames. They curl into my living. There is sugar in my attic, ice on my tile. I am present and useless, like a nose torn from a face and set in a bowl. When I saw God, I used the wrong pronouns. God bricked up my mouth hole. His fists were white as gold. There were roaches in my beard. Now I live like a widow, every day a heave of knitting patterns and sex toys. My family speaks of me with such pride. Nunesh Turagan, they say, his bread is in oil. I thank them for that and for their chromosomes, most of which have been lovely. I am lovely too. My body is hard and choked with juice like a plastic throat stuffed with real grapes. My turn-ons include Ovid and fake leather. My turn-offs have all been ushered into the basement. I'll drink to them and to any victory. The vines are all growing toward the foot of the bed. I am waiting for them to come under the covers. I am the only person still in this house. There is no one here to look away. My first language was Farsi, which is a good first language. It's a beautiful language with a long history of poetry and great poets. But I don't speak it anymore, which is a strangeness. My brain sort of wired itself for this one language, and then now there's all these roads and highways that just decay. This poem is called Do You Speak Persian? I was thinking when Greg was reading his beautiful essay about Larry Levis's relationship to the stars, I was thinking that maybe this poem could be for Larry, to bring Larry into the room and into this reading, even more than he already is here, and everything here is sort of inflected by him. Do you speak Persian? Some days we can see Venus in mid-afternoon. Then, at night, stars separated by billions of miles. Light traveling years to die in the back of an eye. Is there a vocabulary for this? One to make dailiness amplify and not diminish wonder? I've been so careless with the words I already have. I don't remember how to say home in my first language, or lonely, or light. I remember only Dalambrat Tangshode. I miss you, and Shabakher. Good night. How is school going, Kavajun? Dalambrat Tangshode. Are you still drinking? Shabakher. For so long, every step I took was from one tongue to another. To order the world, I need, you need, he, she, it needs. The rest left to a hungry jackal in the back of my brain. Right now, our moon looks like a pale cabbage rose. The Lambert Teng Shode. We are forever folding into the night. Shabacher. I like to, at my readings, I like to read poems by non-me people. Sometimes I feel like I get a little bored with myself. And I was going to read a poem by Larry Levis, but I feel like we just had this extraordinary reading by Larry Levis, and I feel like he's already here. And I also, it's one of those things where, like, when you, it would be like following Tracy Chapman and then just doing a Fast Car cover, like, after she did, you know what I mean? Like, it, so I just pulled this up as I was, right before I came up. It's Indigenous Peoples Day. This is a poem by the Lakota poet Layli Long Soldier. It's called King. I'm so wound with build-up keystroke, dog bite and growl. Wind slides through New Mexican, brilliant white-gray clouds. Spring, early morning, five-minute drive to school. I drop my daughter down curbside, a line of mothers, fathers, steering wheels, to-go cups, coffee filled. Backpacks, pink and blue sneakers, high ponytails, dark eyes, flash goodbye and long and have good day. I'm gaining weight upon the lost body, barely able to lift feet. I can't answer the simplest why. I have much to be thankful for. I seek to be forgotten, still compounded, but that the year would end on a high note. Relationships resolved. Every friendship, the broken, is a friendship again. Mostly. What more to ask for as the dog sleeps and sheds his winter coat? Just earlier tonight, I stood in front of the window and burst out crying. I didn't care if passerby watched. Because just this week, I gave a speech about many things. Among the many, I spoke about feeling. It's our work, I said, and I teetered at the edge of the stage, nearly falling into scraped face futility. Dogs? I've had some dogs. King was a black lab who left for days to fight and lord the block. So busted up as he aged, he'd lie at the edge of the porch, roll over from exhaustion and tumbling into the bed of cacti. I've fallen into depression. I'm sorry. I thought I was fine, then I dropped into what pulls. For so long, my anchor's been pain, a lodestone magnetized and electric. I came to understand what this was, feeling. But who cares now? It's between the page and me. Personal, private. I am two and then twice that as I call my name four times. Layli, 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 Layli. At the door, Layli pain and Layli joy. A child self enters with me. Layli think and Layli do. They soft step to the threshold I imagine. I want no resolution to this friendship of self, halved into halves. Pain, you boss and lord, this existence slow as white blooms along the sky, crumpling into themselves, then loosely breaking away, away, I call my name. I wait for my return, strange, strange stepping toward me, I see no one. It's Layli Long Soldier, not me. Yeah, let's clap for Layli. Layli's incredible. This poem is one that I wrote, though. It's a strange thing to be going, you know, when Larry Levis's poems are in the room and Layli Long Soldier's poems are in the room and all of the previous recipients of this award. It's a nuts list if you look at the list. All of these great poets are in the room and you just sort of waddle in trying to, you know, it feels like 2 7-year-olds stacked on each other's shoulders inside a trench coat, you know. This poem is called Every Drunk Wants to Die Sober, It's How We Beat the Game. Hazrat Ali, son-in-law of the Prophet, was martyred by a poisoned sword while saying his evening prayers, his final words, "I am successful. I am successful. I want to carve it into my forehead. I've been cut into before. I found my body to be hard and bloodless as glass. Still, for effect, I tore my shirt to tourniquets. Let me now be calm for one fucking second. Let me be open to revision. Eternity looms in the corner like a home invader saying, 'Don't mind me. I'm just here to watch you nap.' If you throw prayer beads at a ghost, they will cut through him soft as a saber through silk. I finally have answers to the questions I taught my mother not to ask, but now she won't ask them. As a child, I was so tiny and sweet, she would tuck me in saying, 'Mushbukradet, a mouse should eat you.' I melted away that sweet like sugar in water, like once fresh honey dripping down a thigh. Today, I lean on habit and rarely unstrap my muzzle. It's hard to speak of something so gauche as ambition while the whole wheezing mosaic chips away. But let it be known, I do hope one day to be free of this body's dry wood. If living proves anything, it's that such astonishment is possible. The kite, loosed from its string, outpaces its shadow. An olive tree explodes into the sky, dazzling even the night. I don't understand the words I babble in home movies from Tehran, but I assume they were lovely. I have always been a tangle of tongue and pretty want. In Islam, there are prayers to return anything, even prayers to return faith. I have been going through book after book, pushing the sounds through my teeth. I will keep making these noises as long as deemed necessary until there is nothing left of me to forgive." This is called Juice Box. "Nothing's harder than burying a gun you have come to love. Especially when the barrel's still warm, especially when the soil's still cold. Even the kettle boiling milk for cream is muting its whistle. The proteins floating in your eye stay still, almost reverent. What you're in is a vice, and slowly it's getting tighter. You can't live off dandelion leaves and hot cream forever. Remember fasting as a child, sneaking stale cookies in the dark. Remember the shame, the gold-black vomit in your parents' sink. Since the brain is flesh, and so is the tongue, and so is the throat, and so is the heart, then pleasure of the flesh is the only pleasure there is. Your circulatory system is open now like a crab's. Your blood sloshes freely through your chest like a pomegranate kneaded carefully into a juice box. A single puncture could kill you, but what a death it would be. Ruby sap glimmering through your coat, fields of crimson carpet rolled out at your feet. Few reds stay red for long, few greens stay green. The earth is a dirty contract breaker. Not even words stay words. Passing from mouth to mouth, they color your spit and dye your gums. When the world was flat, people leapt off all the time. Don't bother with goodbyes, they only worsen the stain." I'm going to read a longer poem. This is something that I've been working on for a long, long time, and it's starting to come into clarity. And one of the things that sometimes helps me fully bring a thing into clarity is to see how it sounds in a room with acoustics and faces like rolling their eyes at parts, or you know, the parts where you start to check your phone or whatever might be the part. But it's a little bit longer, so sit back in your seats maybe, or take your shoes off, or lean your head on your beloved shoulder, whatever. It's not like you'll be fine, but it's just a little bit longer than what I've been reading. This is called The Palace. "It's hard to remember who I'm talking to and why. The palace burns, the palace is fire, and my throne is comfy and square. Remember, the old king invited his subjects into his home to feast on stores of apple tarts and sweet lamb. To fest on sweet lamb of stories. He believed they loved him, that his goodness had earned him their goodness. Their goodness dragged him into the street and tore off his arms, plucked his goodness out, plucked his fingers out like feathers. There are no good kings, only beautiful castles. Who here could claim to be merely guilty? The mirror, my life growing monstrous with ease. To be an American, my father left his siblings believing he'd never see them again. He wanted to be Mick Jagger. He went full ghost, wound up working on duck farms for 30 years. Once asleep, a couch, he coughed up a feather. America could be a metaphor, but it isn't. Asleep on the couch, he coughed up a white duck feather. There are no doors in America, only king-sized holes. To be an American is to be a scholar of opportunity. Opportunity costs. Every orange I eat disappears the million peaches, plums, pears I could have eaten, but didn't. In her heaven, opportunity costs. In her heaven, my mother grows peaches, plums, pears, and I eat them till I pass out and wake up in heaven, wake up and eat some more. I couldn't dream of doing anything by halves. Whatever it is, I'll take the whole bouquet. Please, and soon. Are you still listening? Every person I touch costs me 10 million I'll never meet. Persons and persons, inside each, a palace on fire. Inside each, Mick Jagger wearing a gorilla pelt coat covered in ostrich feathers. He calls it glamouflage. What's gone but still seen? Luckless soldiers, the pencil pushed slowly through my brother's tricep. What's gone but still seen? He didn't scream, just let his eyes water. If I smile even a little, they start sharpening their swords. And they're right. This is no time for joy. This is no time. The palace burns. Pencil pushes slowly through my brother's brother. What's gone but still seen? A king governs best in the dark, where you can't see his hands move. A king doesn't see us watching the king. We sew God's initials into our work shirts while our babies get thinner. The babies do not see us watch our babies get thinner. Our babies born addicted to fear of babies. Our babies gumming apples in the sun. America, the broken headstone. America, far enough away from itself. Hello, this is Kavis speaking. I wanted to be Keats, but I've already lived 4 years too long. Hello, this is Keats speaking. It is absurd now to say anything, much less anything new. Hello, this is no one speaking. Hibiscus bloom, wet feathers, a tiny thumb of ash. To be American is to be a hunter. To be American is to be, what? A hunter? A hunter that shoots only money. No, not money. Money. I have a kitchen machine that lets me spin lettuce. There is no elegant way to say this. People with living hearts that could fit in my chest want to melt the city where I was born. At his elementary school in an American suburb, a boy's shirt says, "We did it to Hiroshima, we can do it to Tehran." At his elementary school in an American suburb, a boy's shirt says, "We did it to Hiroshima, we can do it to Tehran." Who will take home the trophy? Roasted goat baying on the spit. A boy's shirt says, "We did it to Hiroshima, we can do it to Tehran." He is asked to turn his shirt inside out, his insides out. After he complies, his parents sue the school district. Our souls want to know how they were made, what is owed. These parents want their boy to want to melt my family, and I live among them. Palace thrown, comfy, burning, I draw it without lifting my pen. I draw it fat as creation, empty as a footprint. How to live, reading poems, breathing shallow, spinning lettuce. America, the shallow trap, how to live, the shallow trap. America, catching only what is too small to eat. The dead keep warm under America while my mother fries eggplants on the stove. I am not there. I am elsewhere in America, writing this, writing this, writing this. English is my mother's first language, but not mine. I am always elsewhere in America. I might have said Badamjan. I might have said Khrahafis, sizzling oil, great fists of smoke, writing this. The first insect drawn by man was a locust. Art is where what we survive survives. Sizzling oil, great fists of smoke. Art, sizzling oil, art, my mother fries eggplant. The first insect drawn by man survives. Who to kiss the prom queen? Who to win the war? America rises, covered in the tiny grains of its own making, fresh bread pocked with flour dust. Mistyping in an email, I write, "I lose you so much today," then leave it. Forbidden mercies, windmills spinning around like drunk teenagers. Any document of civilization is also a document of barbarism, says the palace, burning. I, a man, am what I do not say. America, I warn you, if you invite me into your home, I will linger, losing, kissing my beloveds frankly, pulling up radishes and capping all your pens. There are no good kings, only burning castles. Lose me today, so much. Thanks. It's a weird one. I wrote this book waking up early to write. When sometimes if you are a writer who wakes up early to write, it's very easy to use that as a sort of cudgel to like beat people into accepting your sort of supernatural writerliness, right? But I happen to like writing in the morning. There's nothing supernatural about it. Lots of people like writing at night. Anyways, all this to say, I like writing in the morning because I like to get into the language while my brain is still kind of gummy with dream logic before the mundane prattle of the everyday gets in there and, you know, I start thinking in email speak or in coffee shop orders or whatever. But in lately, it has seemed increasingly unconscionable not to let the argle-bargle of the everyday come into the poems when the argle-bargle of the everyday is so, it seemed like a sort of very sort of privileged position to be able to say, no, I don't want you in here, I only want, you know. So I've been trying to write at night, and it doesn't feel as comfortable to me. And consequentially, I'm writing these, like, you know, 10-page whatever that was instead of, you know, my comfortable little. Anyways, I'm going to read some other poems, and then we can all talk to each other. This is called Orchids Are Sprouting from the Floorboards, which Caitlin referenced in her beautiful opening. Orchids are sprouting from the floorboards. Orchids are gushing out from the faucets. The cat mews orchids from his mouth. His whiskers are also orchids. The grass is sprouting orchids. It is becoming mostly orchids. The trees are filled with orchids. The tire swing is twirling with orchids. The sunlight on the wet cement is a white orchid. a bouquet of orchids lifts from the car's tailpipe. Teenagers are texting each other pictures of orchids on their phones, which are also orchids. Old men in orchid penny loafers furiously trade orchids. Mothers fill bottles with warm orchids to feed their infants, who are orchids themselves. Their coos are a kind of orchid. The clouds are all orchids. They are raining orchids. The walls are all orchids. The teapot is an orchid. The blank easel is an orchid. And this cold is an orchid. Oh, Lydia, we miss you terribly. I grew up all over the place, but a lot of my particular all over the place was in the American Midwest. And like once or so a year, we would take these family pilgrimages into Chicago to go to Reza's restaurant. It was the only Persian anything within a 10-hour driving radius. And so it would be the biggest deal in the world. My brother and I would know exactly what we were going to order off the menu. My order would complement his order and vice versa. You can ever go out to eat even. So it was this huge deal. This is a poem sort of about that, to the extent that anything is about anything. This is sort of about that. You need to know that Persians and Arabs are not the same thing, which hopefully you guys know, but yeah, those are two distinct people with distinct histories and many sub-histories within them. Reza's Restaurant, Chicago, 1997. The waiters milled about, filling sumac shakers, clearing away plates of onion and radish. My father pointed to each person, whispered, "Persian," about the old man with the silver beard, whispered, "Arab," about the woman with the eye mole, "Persian," the teenager pouring water, "White," the man on the phone. I was 8 and watching and amazed. I asked how he could possibly tell when they were all brown-skinned, dark-haired like us. Almost everyone in the restaurant looked like us. He smiled a proud little smile, a warm nest of lips, said, "It's easy," said, "We're just uglier." He returned to his lamb, but I was baffled, hardly touched my qaymah. I had huge glasses and bad teeth. I felt plenty Persian. When the woman with light eyes and blonde brown hair left our check, my father looked at me. I said, "Arab?" He shook his head, laughed. We drove home. I grew up. It took years to put together what my father meant that day. My father, who listened exclusively to the Rolling Stones, who called the Beatles a band for girls. My father, who wore only black, even around the house, whose arms could cut chicken wire and make stew and bulged with old farm scars. My father built the world. The first sound I ever heard was his voice whispering the azan in my right ear. I didn't need anything else. My father cherished that we were ugly, so being ugly was blessed. I smiled with all my teeth. Thank you. I appreciate it. I know that we're all grateful to be here. I know that you're grateful to be here, and I feel very, very grateful to be here. So don't feel any sort of compulsion towards that end. I feel it in the way that you're looking at me. And hopefully I'm returning it. This poem is called "I Won't Lie, This Plague of Gratitude." So this book is sort of an account of going from being a not very good person to someone who works very, very hard to come out at the end of the day roughly neutral, you know, or better on a good day. And one of the strange things about that for me was that I didn't really have a relationship in my past life to gratitude. You know, I was saying to the class this morning, I just sort of spent my life lurching from crisis to crisis, and there was no real time to reflect. There wasn't an occasion for gratitude or an occasion for me to become aware that I should have gratitude. One of the strange things that happened to me as my life started to improve was that all of these gratitudes began to come into my life, and I didn't really have an experiential relationship to gratitude. I had well-trod psychic algorithms for what to do with pain and despair and loneliness and crisis, right? But I didn't have those for what to do with gratitude. It was really sort of baffling and painful. this is about that, again, to the extent anything is about anything. This is called I Won't Lie, This Plague of Gratitude. That preamble was longer than the poem. I won't lie, this plague of gratitude is hard to bear. I was comfortable in my native pessimism, not this spun sugar fantasy. Last night, I made actual cake. There were no worms in the flour, no bloody whorls in the eggs. Afterwards, the minor holiday below my waistband remained festive as ever. When I touched two breasts, each one was my favorite. Not long ago, I was hard to even hug, like ribbons of cartilage cut from a lamb. I dressed in shredded roses and pistachio shells. I drank an entire language and flung tar at whatever moved until the world cut me open like a tube of paint, until it crushed me between its fingers like a hornet. None of it was graceful. I had to learn to love people one at a time, singing, "Hey, diddle diddle, will you suffer me a little?" How could they say no? How could they say anything? I kept biting my tongue. I kept clicking my heels. Now I am cheery and Germanic, like a drawer full of strudel. I always wanted to be a saint, but I thought I'd be one of the miserable ones, sainted by pain, burnt alive inside a brazen bull. Instead, I weep openly at obnoxious beauty. Cello music comes in from blocks away, and I lose it completely. There is a word for these fits of incomprehensible delight. I said it last night when my mouth was full of cake. Ways to harm a thing. Throw scissors at it. Fill it with straw and set it on fire, or set it off for the colonies with only some books and dinner plates and a stuffed bear named Friend Bear for me to lose in New Jersey. Did I say me? Things have been getting less and less hypothetical since I unhitched myself from your bedpost. Everyone I love is too modern to be caught grieving. In order to be consumed, first you need to be consumable, but there is not a single part of you I could fit in my mouth. In a dream, I pull back your foreskin and reveal a fat vase stuffed with crow feathers. This seems a faithful translation of the real thing. Another way to harm something is to melt its fuse box, make it learn to live in the dark. I still want to suck the bones out from your hands, plant them like the seeds we found in an antique textbook, though those never sprouted and may not have even been seeds. When I was a sailor, I found a sunken ziggurat, spent weeks diving through room after room, discovering this or that sacred shroud. One way to bury something is to bury it forever. When I was water, you poured me out over the dirt. At poetry readings, I think that whenever someone says two or three more, or like X or X plus one more, they always mean X plus one. So I'm going to read two more. This poem, it begins with an epigraph by St. Augustine, which is a very sort of hoity-toity sentence. But I was reading this book in which I encountered this line by St. Augustine where he says, "We must admit that a crying man is better than a laughing worm." I read it two or three times and I was like, must we, right? Like, I don't know, a laughing worm sounds pretty great, right? And crying man doesn't sound all that fun. So this poem is called In Praise of the Laughing Worm. Lacking lungs, it laughs through its skin. Each pore laughing, it bores into the dead's dead, dead. Laughing through their solemnity, tunneling its name across their dust, lusty as a pharaoh, the laughing worm tangles around its beloved. They laugh together, traveling up to the surface. They laugh, saying, "It is so strange that sun is, that wind does, and rain? How to even speak about rain?" They laugh together like a mangled theory, like cold fingers crossed, then pull apart. The beloved stops laughing. Its body rolls into a guilty coil. It says, "The dead who fed me yesterday weren't laughing. says they never learned what they came here to learn. Slowly, the beloved skulks back into soil, its mineral syntax, but the laughing worm just laughs, inches forward, gentle enough to button a shirt, gleaming like a beaver eye. The laughing worm crawls past anthills, bullfrogs, wild radish, thinking nothing that could be put into words, laughing with each of its five hearts. I think the fatal flaw of that poem might be that it depends on the knowledge that worms have five hearts. Sometimes you just write your happy worm poem. Thank you all so much for being here. Again, so, so grateful for your company. I'm grateful for the hospitality that you guys have all shown me. Truly, 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 this is extraordinary. Thank you all so much. I'm profoundly grateful to each and every one of you. This poem is called Portrait of the Alcoholic, Floating in Space with Severed Umbilicus. In Fort Wayne, I drank the seniors, Old Milwaukee, Old Crow. In Indianapolis, I stopped. Now I regret every drink I never took. All around, coffee grounds and eggshells, this sweating, a mouthful of lime. As a boy, I stole a mint green bra from a laundromat, took it home to try on while my parents slept, filled its cups with the smallest turnips in our pantry. The underwire grew into me like a strangler fig. My blood roiled then as now. Back on Earth, frog spit is dripping down wild aloe spikes. Salmon are bullying their way upstream. There is a pond I leapt into once with a lonely blonde boy. When we scampered out, one of us was in love. I could not be held responsible for desire. He could not be held at all. I wonder where he is now. If he looked up, he might see me, a sparkling. I always hoped that when I died, I would know why. My brother will be so sad. He will tell his daughters I was better than I was. He will leave out my cruel drunk nights, the wet mattresses, my driving alone into cornfields, unsure whether I'd drive out. I wish he were here now. He could be here. This cave is big enough for everyone. Look at all the diamonds.